The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
The Minstrel of the Dawn is here to make you laugh and bend your ear. Up the steps you'll hear him climb, all full of thoughts, all full of rhymes. Listen to the pictures flow, across the room into your mind they go. Listen to the strings, they jangle and dangle while the old guitar rings. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan making her seventh appearance on the show, Deb Radwan. Deb, welcome back to Carefree Highway Revisited.
Thank you so much. I can't believe it's been seven times.
I know. That is far and away a record, and one that I don't know if it'll ever be surpassed, but great to have you on again. So today we are talking about Minstrel of the Dawn from the Sit Down Young Stranger album. And of course, that record came out in 1970. And I have to tell you, you picked one of my very favorite Lightfoot songs, although it's one that is a little mysterious and not a whole lot has been written about it in terms of criticism, either positive or negative. It has had very little literary analysis. So I guess I'm wondering, why did you want to talk about it today?
Well, truthfully, this song was on my radar. I liked it. But then I saw him perform it in concert, and it was magical. And ever since then, I've had a little bit more interest, and it just moved up on the charts. There was something about him performing it that was just like, oh my gosh, this is magnificent.
You know, I was going to be asking you that a little later on. Had you ever seen him perform it in concert? And it would have been interesting for me because clearly he wouldn't have had the strings, which is an integral part of the song. The reason that I love it so much is it is a cinematic song like many of his good ones are, but it's also one of the songs where I know he's speaking autobiographically.
I found out some stuff.
Okay, well, we will get into that.
Yeah.
It's just that my own impression is that he's referring to himself in the third person.
Yeah.
There's very few references to I in the song, but it has always seemed like he was in some way portraying himself. And there's different levels on which that happens. And we will get into those as we sort of delve into the origins of the song.
One of the things that I really love about this song, too, is it's one, along with just a handful of others, where there seems to be a connection between the protagonist in the song and the audience. So you kind of get that with The Traveling Minstrel Show, If It Should Please You, maybe a little bit of Susan's Floor. There just seems to be some connection where he's talking to the audience. Go fetch some wine and set it here, you know? And I really like that connection, that intimacy of it.
I know that you said it was magical and when you saw him perform it in concert. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could describe that just a little bit more about what made it so magical, apart from just the fact that he was always magical in concert.
Yeah.
You know, there was always an aura about him. He was just a total professional, absolutely knew how to captivate an audience. What was it about that particular night?
Well, actually, I've seen him perform it several times. Of course, his finger picking and Carter's or Terry's, whosoever it was, and the combination that he's our troubadour and he's speaking about a troubadour, and it does sound autobiographical in a lot of ways. And when he says, listen to the strings, they jangle, you're listening to the strings jangle, it was just magical. I don't know how else to describe it.
Sounds like it was a moment where you really had to be there to hear the kind of narration of what he was actually doing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the lead guitar, because in this, if you take away the strings, it's only three pieces. It's guitar, lead guitar, and bass. There's no percussion on it at all. And it doesn't need anything else. I mean, the strings are nice on the record, but it doesn't seem to me that you had to have them.
And he didn't have them in the concert, and it was magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's because more of the focus was on the guitar. It was beautiful. And I think the other thing that made it special, and maybe we'll talk about it a little later, was he told the story about coming out of the coma. And this being the first song he heard. And he kind of set it up. He said, you know, when I was in this coma, my sister Beverly used to come in every day and she would play my music to me. He said, when I woke up, the first song I heard was this song. So then that kind of elevated it for me, you know, that whatever it was, this was the song that reached into that dark hole and pulled him out of it.
There's an extra layer of beauty to and meaning to
yes.
the song. And I had heard that. I didn't hear the part about Beverly being involved.
Yeah.
But but I had heard that when he was coming out of the coma, that he did hear the song. But I couldn't be sure if it was in his head or whether there was somebody actually playing it on a cassette or whatever. But the fact that it was in his head, I mean, that's really his welcome back.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And in Nicholas Jennings' book, he says, and I'm quoting here, it was sort of a hallucination. It happened just as I came to, and one of the nurses was filling up my feeding apparatus. The whole song with me singing, but sounding so much more pristine than on the record. It was the most amazing thing. So it was almost like all his senses were heightened and the music was almost a spiritual moment for him. So when he was telling this story and when I read it in the book, it was just like, yeah, there's something about it. When I heard him sing it live, him on the guitar, it elevated the song for me.
You know, to think about it being more pristine than on the record, it's hard for me to imagine anything more pristine than the way he delivered it. And I should segue into this by saying that this is one of a very few Lightfoot songs or any songs that I could listen to at any time doing anything under any circumstances. There are some where I'd really have to be in a particular setting, time, place, activity, whatever, for it really to hit home. But this is one where I could listen to it six times a day and throughout the day when I'm out and about my business, and it is always going to fit. Is there a setting for you that would be perfect for this, or is this another one that you could listen to anytime?
Well, I can listen to it anytime. I do find that I listen to my music most often in the car. But if I could describe a perfect setting, I think it would be having it play when the sun is coming up.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Okay. The Dawn.
And, right.
And of course, he did name his company Early Morning Music for many years. I don't know if he kept that moniker until the very end, but for a long, long time, that was the name of his publishing company. Well, let's talk a little bit about how the song got written. And again, going back to the Nicholas Jennings book, we do know that when Gordon was working in Cleveland, and I've talked about that at La Cave, when he was maybe in residency there, or he was playing a few shows there, he went to see Stepan Fetchit, who is the African-American comedian who was the first African-American to become a millionaire in show business in American history. And the name ended up in the song, but it's clearly not about the characters that that actor, whom we'll talk more about a little bit later, but the idea that this character will make you laugh and bend your ear. And so that was one of the few things that Jennings said about this song.
I read that as well, but I found an article that was written in 2008 by Red Shea's daughter. And I sought it out because I had heard somewhere that this song was written about Red. He was the inspiration. And so when I found the article, it was in the Globe and Mail. And what she wrote was, Gordon wrote a song called Minstrel of the Dawn that was inspired by Red. I believe it captured the playful life of my father that he possessed. He loved telling jokes. And of course, I kind of Googled Red just to get more information on him. He traveled in the carnivals. He jumped freight trains. He was a real jokester. And then one of the articles I read said, Red Shea is universally credited with having been Lightfoot's most distinctive original supporting player, adding his lucid filigree lead runs seamlessly into his music.
What a way to phrase that.
Yes. And when he said filigree lead runs, that's kind of what that song, when he talks about, listen to the strings, they jangle. That's kind of what I imagine is this filigreed music. So I think it's about Red. I'm sure there are some autobiographical aspects. I don't think you can keep that out of it. But I think Red was maybe the inspiration, his guitar playing, his joking around, kind of the checkered past of traveling with carnivals. And as a troubadour, they just travel all over. They really just go from place to place to place to perform. So I think it might be about Red.
You know, you've sold me. It makes perfect sense that it would be about Red. And this is a good place, Deb, to stop and talk a little bit about the whole idea of minstrel tradition.
Yes.
And of course, it goes back to medieval European times and maybe before. And the minstrels were wandering entertainers and they sang all sorts of songs, love ballads, epic songs, religious music. And then sometimes they would be sort of town crier kind of people saying, okay, well, here's what's going on in this burg or this area dozens of miles away where I was two nights ago. So kind of the news source, if you want to put it another way. It was very popular in the 1840s. And then a guy named Edwin Christie and the new Christie Minstrels, going to get that name, who wrote Goodnight Ladies, among other things, and formed the Christie Minstrels. And then it became part of the music scene in the United States until about the 1950s. But of course, it took the form of shows that were very race-based and were not intended to be nourishing or edifying at all. I mean, they were really mocking African Americans. That being said, the tradition of the wandering troubadour really goes back hundreds of years. And it would not surprise me if we could have gotten inside Gordon's head, although I don't think he ever came out and said this. I think there's a very good chance that it was about Red.
And, you know, that troubadour, traveling minstrel, that goes back to the Renaissance. I mean, Henry VIII had troubadours in his court, and they would come out and do love songs. And I think of songs like Your Love's Return, the Minor Ballad, those all have a flavor of that minstrel sound where they're telling a tale or it's a love song, or even songs like Mr. Tambourine Man has a little bit of that quality. So I think there was a lot of inspiration there from the traveling troubadours and the minstrels from 1500s forward, and throwing a little inspiration there. And you've got a quintessential Gordon song. You know, that's just perfection.
And he did it so well. And we're going to start talking about why it was such a beautiful song right now.
We'll be right back to our conversation with Deb Radwan about Minstrel of the Dawn. But first, a word from a podcast partner.
The American West is a place of lore and legend, of triumphs and tragedies. No one can tell the true stories of the West better than author Rick Steber. And now there's a podcast showcasing his work. It's called Writing the West, and every episode will feature his short stories and his poetry. If you want to know the true stories of cowboys, pioneers, miners, and Native Americans, this 15-minute podcast is for you. Writing the West is available on Spotify, Audible, Podbean, or wherever you get your listening matter. That's Writing the West, the work of Rick Steber.
We Radio is so much different than it was in the 80s. We had it all. The music, the movies, the DJs, and morning shows. Back to the 80s Radio is a show from the 80s in podcast form. We bring the memories from that awesome decade back. Join Toscano and Chang every Friday as they take you on a ride back in time, sharing their experiences and laughs. Stop on by and discover some of the wacky things this crazy duo comes up with. They talk about it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the greatest decade. Don't miss the greatest 80s podcast in the world. Back to the 80s Radio.
The Minstrel of the Dawn is here to make you laugh and bend your ear. So he's going to get your attention. He's going to make you happy. Mm-hmm. And it could be with a joke or some kind of gag, or he may just make you laugh in just the joy of being in his presence.
Storytelling.
And I haven't done a whole lot of digging into what Red was mm-hmm. like, but I know enough to get an idea that the guy had a real playful spirit. And he was also amazingly talented. And he did do those filigreed runs on this song. It was he who was doing, I guess this is either before Terry came on the scene or maybe just wasn't playing on that song. Up the steps, you'll hear him climb, all full of thoughts, all full of rhymes. And I have to be honest with you, until I read the lyrics, I thought the lyric was a roll of thunks, all full of rhymes. You know, just you hear these footsteps, kind of boom, boom, boom. Because that makes sense that he's coming up the steps. So you can hear him coming. But the images that I get from this is that he's coming to see you. You don't have to go find him. He's going to come to you. And that is kind of what minstrels did. I mean, they weren't going door to door necessarily, right, but they were moving. It wasn't like, hey, I'm going to be in this place. You come to me. No, right, he's going to come to you and entertain, uplift, right, inform, all of those kinds of things. Listen to the pictures flow across the room. Into your mind they go. And this minstrel is being so vivid with the music and the mm-hmm. words. You can't help but conjure up images.
Right.
And the implication is that they are the exact ones that he wants you to see.
Yeah.
Now, it never works that way. If you have 100 people listening to the same song or the same radio show, everyone is going to have their own version of what those mountains looked like, what that sunset looked like, what that monster looked like, what the narrator looks like. But in this scenario, exactly what the minstrel wants you to see in your mind, you're seeing it.
Yeah. And even that description of how it's getting to you, the words are flowing from him across the room and into your head. Even that line is just so beautiful and so clear and vivid. And I think you're right. It's almost like it's going from my brain into your brain.
And that does bring up another observation that I've made. I'm making a slight side trip here. That's the beauty of listening to music or listening to something that you can't see. Mm-hmm. You know, that pictures have to come to your head. Whereas if you're watching a movie in TV, there's no imagination. You've already seen everything.
Right. They've done the work for you.
So you kind of have to just put your mind in neutral, which I know sounds a little harsh, but you don't have to do as much processing of it. It's why a lot of people, especially my mother, God rest her soul, really did not like TV. She much preferred radio and records, although toward the end of her life, she really enjoyed going to the movies. Listen to the strings. They jangle and dangle while the old guitar rings. So this is somebody who lived in a time when there was a guitar to be had. A lute in the Renaissance and then a guitar, right, a little later on. I forget the history of guitars at this point.
Mandolins.
Could have been a mandolin, mm-hmm. Yeah. He'll talk of life out on the street. He'll play it sad and say it sweet. Now, that suggests that this guy has been a street busker, that he's played mm-hmm. with his guitar case open and people throw money in or whatever when they go by. You see these folks all the time in big cities. And maybe in carnivals too, but certainly in big cities. And in my particular experience, in the London Underground, almost every tube stop I went to, there was somebody who was playing guitar on the platform. And so you'd throw a few pence in there. Mm-hmm. But he knows about what life is like on the street not necessarily because he's homeless, but because he knows what the word on the street is. Those are quotation marks.
Well, you know, and the old minstrels, they traveled. They would go from court to court. They talked to people along the ways in their journeys and picked up stories and wisdom, and they had it rough, and they probably were busking for money when they didn't have a gig at the local castle.
There weren't streets in the way you and I think of them.
Right.
There were public byways and
That's
roads
right.
and things like that. Look into his shining face. Of loneliness, you'll always find a trace. Now, being a musician is always a lonely existence. And if you're going back to the Renaissance or before, about a wandering minstrel who's living basically by their wits, you have literally no home to call your own. I mean, you're just always on the road. It's going to be the next county, the next castle, the next dukedom, the next palace, the next place that you're going to be, but you don't ever go home from that. It's just an endless tour of different places. And that plays into what Red's life was like as well.
Yeah. When they talk about a shining face, I think of shining eyes, which usually means there's a little tear. If your eyes are shiny, maybe there's a little tear there. When he says of loneliness, you'll always find a trace, I'm thinking of a tear in his eye.
We're going to talk about shining eyes a little later on, because he's going to use that phrase again. But yeah, so there may be a tear in your eye because loneliness can be painful.
That's right.
And if you are not only lonely, but on the road all the time, you're going to get tired and lonely. When you're tired and lonely, you tend to make just the best decisions, don't you? So there it is. Then the song goes into more of a straight 4-4, because up to now it's gone into 1-2-3-4, five, six, 1-2-3-4. So now it's going into a minstrel of the changing tide. He'll ask for nothing but his pride. So he's talking about the changing of society. That's another thing that minstrels do, is that they were supposed to bring the news, such as it was, of what was going on in the world. He's not asking for wealth. He's not going after fame necessarily. He doesn't want to be rich. What he does want is his dignity. And in this context, it means he wants to be listened to. He wants to be given a fair hearing. He doesn't want you to just walk by or walk out of the room.
Right.
Just sit him down upon that chair. Go fetch some wine and set it there. There is a little bit of a literary tradition behind that. Now, I liked what you said about saying to the audience, hey, welcome him in, you know, and give him something to drink. But he's talking about a time when musicians just sort of went out and sang for their supper. Before the rock and roll era, or before musicians commanded these outrageous salaries, before the spectacle became what you went to see rather than the music. And when I think of sort of contemporary people in the mass media, okay, I think about Frank Sinatra and I think about Elvis. There were probably people before that, but those are the people that come to mind. But the historical aspect of it is that there was a Spanish author named Gonzalo de Berceo, and he wrote a book about the miracles of the Virgin Mary, which was probably recited or adapted by minstrels. And it wrote about being happy to narrate the stories for a minstrel, and then you were supposed to give him un vaso de bon vino, which in old Spanish means a glass of good wine. So in other words, he's happy to tell his stories and to have his recompense be minimal, just something to make him feel welcome and appreciated, because the message is more important than, you know, anything else, not about his image or how he looks or how many fans he has, so to speak. So there's a deep literary, in addition to a deep cultural tradition that's being reflected here as well.
It's like someone wanting you to read their book. You know, they have a story to tell and they want someone to listen to it.
I think that's something that is part of the human experience. As we get older, we realize that we have more yesterdays than tomorrows. And my grandparents, especially my grandfather, just had all sorts of stories about his childhood and coming from South Georgia out to LA and raising a family. And of course, I could have listened to him for days on end, because that's the kind of thing, that's the magic of stories. And it still goes on today, doesn't it? A minstrel of the dawn is near, just like a step and fetch it here. Now, there's that reference again to the comedian. And I wonder how many people would actually get the overtones to step and fetch it. Now, minstrel shows, I think there are a few people who get the idea. Okay, yes, it's blackface, it's racist, it's terrible. It wouldn't go over these days and probably wouldn't have gone over 20, 30 years ago either. But I don't know how many people would recognize the term step and fetch it outside maybe of the African-American community. So I'm wondering if you have any comments on that.
No, I can only think it goes back to that comedian that he saw in Cleveland and was referencing some of his comedy.
Let me digress again here, this time about the character step and fetch it. It was the stage name of a black actor named Lincoln Perry. And he parlayed this characterization of a lazy, not very bright, quote unquote, jive talking guy. And it was a send up. And of course, it was offending African Americans because they're thinking, oh my God, you know, look at what you're making us look like. And even after he had gotten out of the public spotlight and after he died, the impression was still there, and people thought of Step and Fetch It as being, I don't want to say Uncle Tom, but kind of the stereotype that they desperately wanted to break away from.
Right.
Because it was what white America was seeing.
Right.
And what they were concluding, okay, well, all African Americans are like that. At the same time, Lincoln Perry was the first African-American to become a millionaire off of show business, at least the one that we know of. And so there are some African-Americans who said Lincoln Perry is the first black superstar and kind of a trailblazer in that way. So I'm not saying that we should necessarily comment on that. I'm just giving you the sort of historical background.
Right.
He's like an old-time troubadour, just wanting life and nothing more. Now, Deb, I'm interested in your thoughts on this because it's a little bit of a mysterious line here. It's beautiful, but just wanting life and nothing more, does that imply that all he wants to do is survive? He doesn't want to grow. He doesn't want to improve. He doesn't want to achieve something. What do you think Gordon's talking about in this line?
Well, an old-time troubadour, they traveled and they played. And they moved on to the next place and they played and people raved and applauded for them and threw them coins. And I think it's kind of what modern musicians who go out on the road and they just want to perform and be listened to and people applaud and they get paid for it. And that's living. I think that's all he's saying here is, he's just wanting life and nothing more. And life to him is going place to place and singing and people listening and hearing him and giving him some wine and some coins. And he goes to the next place and does it all over again. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what modern musicians do.
With the exception that, to paraphrase Joe Walsh, they have a mansion, forget the price. I've never been there. They tell me it's nice.
Yeah.
And there is some conspicuous consumption that goes along with being a musician today that you wouldn't have had back then because
of
that
course.
Was literally all there was.
Yes.
So I guess what he may be saying is that this is his life and he wants that life to the fullest.
Right.
He doesn't want to explore anybody else's life.
Right. And I think if you just look at Gordon's life, now he wrote this when he was a much younger man, but even as an older man, what did he want? Of course, he had the nice home and everything, but he wanted to still tour. He still wanted to be on stage. He still wanted to see his fans. He still wanted his music played. He was still touring at 80-something years old because that was, he used to say, I love the work. I think that was living. What did he really want? He wanted to still do the work.
We'll be right back to our conversation with Deb Radwan about Minstrel of the Dawn. But first, a word from a podcast partner.
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is.
Hey, do you like classic albums? Technically, like, the, you know, the 20th century albums. Such as, like, Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones. I've only had Beatle episodes so far, however, I'll be doing more. But, welcome to my show, or rather, hey, welcome to... check out my show! all those years ago, a classic album podcast with the dipping sauce. As you can see, the George Harrison reference. I review classic albums, not of those, the likes of Beethoven, the likes of the Beatles and Rolling Stones, and like I mentioned earlier, or what have you. So yeah, check it out. It's every Monday. I do albums, conspiracies, songs, all that jazz. So just check it out. All Those Years Ago, a classic album podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's interesting. You mentioned that, I mean, he had the nice house. His worth when he died, I think, was something, he was worth $20 million, or he had, right, you know, that amount of wealth. I mean, he could have lived very nicely, but he really just loved being out on the road. And I think there are some musicians who continue to tour into their old age, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm, either because they have to financially or they realize there is nothing else for them. Mm-hmm. And so they're doing it more or less out of compulsion. I think with Lightfoot, he did it because he truly wanted to.
Yeah, I agree. And he said it over and over again. He loves the fans. He loves the work. You look at the guys in the band carrying on his legacy. They could all easily retire, but they love the work. They love to go and perform and sing his songs and through the old time troubadours.
And I hope that they continue to do that as long as there are people who are willing to listen.
That's right.
Look into his shining eyes, and if you see a ghost, don't be surprised. Now, we talked about this a little while ago with the shining mm-hmm. eyes, which implies that there's teardrops there.
Yeah.
The guy is on the verge of crying. But it makes me wonder who or what the ghost is supposed to be. And we've heard Gordon talk about the ghost from the wishing well, but that to me seems very far removed from right. what we're talking about here. So you have any thoughts on what the ghost is supposed to be?
Well, again, it's kind of hard to say because he wrote this as a young man.
Yeah.
But when I look at it from the perspective of him singing it as an older person, I think of all the troubadours who came ahead of him, all the people who inspired him to write this song and others. You know, that there are ghosts in the troubadour's past that he's carrying with him. And when he sings a song or performs, that all of those ghosts are in his eyes. You're hearing and seeing other memories, other people who came before. To me, that's kind of what I think of.
I hear what you're saying in terms of the tradition. And the folk tradition is a perfect example of that. So right. it sounds like it's the heritage that goes along with being a troubadour and
right.
any kind of musician, really, but certainly yeah. a troubadour. And I think about the people who came before Gordon that were doing that kind of thing. Pete Seeger comes to mind.
Right.
Woody Guthrie comes to mind.
Yes.
Lead Belly comes to mind. There are others.
That he's carrying with him when he sings those songs.
Yeah, or somebody is.
Right.
The person that he's singing about is carrying right. these people. The minstrel boy will understand. He holds a promise in his hand. He talks of better days ahead, and by his word, your fortune's read. Now, this is another aspect of being a gypsy, although being a gypsy has its own connotations. But he's talking about this guy being a fortune teller. Now, Gordon has never exactly been a pessimist, but he's never been sort of a wide-eyed optimist, idealist. Right. about life either. I mean, he certainly went through his share of bad stuff in his life, some of which was self-inflicted, some of which was not. I'm just wondering, where does this idea of the fortune is coming? I mean, is this talking about this minstrel being just chronically optimistic, or is this person also a palm reader? What do you think he's talking about here?
Well, I don't think it's a palm reader, but I do think that there is an optimism. When you listen to music, it lifts you up. It is a positive experience. You feel better after listening to it. Even if some of the songs make you cry, it makes you feel better. You know, it's all about the feeling that you're getting through his music and his words and his guitar playing. And that's the promise in his hands. And maybe I'm being a little Pollyanna about it, but I don't think he's saying, oh, it's all going to be rosy from here. I think his stories tell of some of those tough times, and but some beautiful times. And somehow when you come out from listening to music, you just feel good.
Yeah, if you're choosing to listen to that, it means that you like it. Because if you don't like it, you either choose not to listen to it or you change the station.
Right.
So that's probably, you're listening to this with the expectation that you're going to have some sort of positive feeling about it. A very deft turn of phrase there.
Yes.
The minstrel of the dawn is gone. I hope he'll call before too long. What I'm thinking is that this guy has come at sunup and now it's full on day. Let's say that this guy showed up at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's now 9:30. It's not dawn anymore. So this guy's minstrelsy, which we'll talk about in a second or two, is over, at least for this day. Mm-hmm. He's moving on and we'll see, you know, tomorrow, same time, same station. The other thing I think of is that it could be his muse. And in that sense, he might be talking about Red, because I can envision Gordon and Red and maybe John jamming all night until the sun comes up and then realizing, okay, Red is just a little bit of energy left to keep the story going or to keep the session going or to come up with some idea. Or maybe the idea is that Lightfoot wrote all of his best music early in the morning. I really don't know. I love the way that this is the conclusion of the song, that the minstrel has now moved on.
Right.
We don't really know when he's coming back again.
I always thought this would be a good concert closer.
I hadn't thought of that because it's almost too beautiful to close, whereas I would expect that it would be something that everybody's going to know and everybody's going to be singing along, and there's going to be a lot of gusto involved with it.
Well, he can do an encore,
okay,
but it's kind of a signal that, okay,
okay,
we're
that
moving
might
on now.
Maybe it's the encore, yeah. Or if he says, okay, we'll do one more, you know, maybe after the encore, maybe he's called back for a second one or something like that. And if you meet him, you must be the victim of his minstrelsy. And it's interesting, he's saying, we are the victims. Is this him being modest about himself? Is he being kind of humorous about it? Or is he casting aspersions, you know, with the idea of, you know, who wants to be woken up at 6 o'clock in the morning?
I don't think of a victim in a negative term. I think it's like you're under his spell. And so you're a victim in that regard, but I don't think of it as disparaging. I think it's just, if you meet him, you must be under his spell.
I like the way you said that. I think the word victim is always going to have some sort of negative connotation. Yeah. So the word does invite some questions, but I agree with you. And I like the way that he phrased that. So the song appeared on what became known as If You Can Read My Mind. And it, of course, that record started out as Sit Down, Young Stranger.
Right.
It was his fifth original album. It was the first one he did for Reprise. And it's the best-selling original album of his career. It was the first song on the record.
That surprised me. I didn't know that.
I first heard it as the first song on one of the sides of Gord's Gold.
That's when I heard
it. So I can understand why he put it there and why he put it in the collection, you know, when he was doing the collection, why it was there. But yeah, it was the very first one, was not released as a single, which I understand because this isn't a toe tapper.
Right.
It's a beautiful song, but it wouldn't have sold as a single. The album went to 20 in Australia, number 8 in Canada, number 12 in the US, and number 6 in the UK. And I believe that is the first time he had hit the charts in England. It's time for us to take a look at the musical aspects of the song. And I have to say, Deb, I can't pick a single one out. It all works as perfectly as any song I have ever heard done by anyone.
Yeah.
The lead guitar is tasteful and it's jovial and it's filigreed. There's that word.
Yep, I love that word because I think it fits.
Yeah, it does. Lightfoot's picking, which has the great pacing to it and then leads you into the more rapid part of what the last two-thirds of the song is going to be. The string arrangement, which was done by Randy Newman, which I think is even better than what he did with Approaching Lavender.
Agree.
The melody, I mean, it was all just so perfect. Absolutely perfect. And it sounds about as contrived as the weather, but I'm sure that they went through a lot of takes.
Yeah.
And they really worked on that. I don't know that anybody will ever know how many takes it took. And I'm sure Randy Newman, who is certainly not somebody who slaps things together.
Right.
Probably was there saying, no, we've really got to tighten this up or however he talks. What's your favorite musical aspect of the song? Or are you kind of with me saying it's just all flawless?
Yeah, you pretty much summed it up. The finger picking, the guitar work, the change of tempo is perfect. That transition is perfect. Of course, I'm a lyrics person, so the lyrics always get to me. It's just a beautiful, beautiful song. Now, for me, it carries all these other things of being the first song he woke up to and seeing it in concert, and that makes everything special.
I would like to have seen him play it in concert with the stripped down version and see if it still managed to send me the way that the one with the strings did.
I think it would send you more.
It might very well.
Yeah.
Because again, it's only the three. It was Gordon and Red, and it was Rick Haynes. I guess John had left the band by that time. And then Randy Newman. And that was it. There was nobody else that played anything else on that particular song. But you talked about seeing it in concert. He played it 307 times in concert. And clearly he didn't have an orchestra with him.
Right.
The first time was in June of 1971. And he played it at the Royal Albert Hall in London. And then the last time was in Tarrytown, New York on April 8th of 2022. So about a year before he passed away. So this was obviously one that a lot of people had a lot of chances to see perform, and I wasn't one of them. And that disappoints me because I think it would have been, again, as you said, so magical to have seen that. I can't find anybody who covered this song, and I am okay with that. You know,
I am too.
You and I know, run hot and cold on cover versions of Gordon's songs, but this is one that I think I almost hope nobody ever tries to do it.
It would be hard to come up to that standard, I think, because it is so perfectly constructed. It would be tough to come close.
Yeah, and I think the only thing you could do with it was try to imitate what Gordon did and what the producers did and what I have to give props to Randy Newman.
Right.
I don't think anybody could do anything but repeat it. And I know they couldn't exceed it. So my thinking is, why even bother?
Right.
There's no point in doing that.
Yeah.
So, Deb, as we're kind of wrapping up with this song, and I should tell you that it gives me a great deal of satisfaction to talk about a song that's meant so much to me in my lifetime, to be talking to somebody who has been as much a part of this musical journey and this podcast journey as anybody else. Any closing thoughts on the song?
No, I was just thrilled that no one had taken it yet. And that I was able to do it because it is a special song. And there were some anecdotes that I wanted to share. Every time I listen to it, it just has a special feeling around it.
Deb Radwan, this podcast would literally not exist without you. So I wanted to thank you again for taking the journey with me. And we're going to go for number 8 next season.
Gosh, I hope there's some left over for me.
Oh, we got a lot to do. Don't worry.
All right. Hey, thanks for having me again. I love it. I love this podcast and you do such a great job. Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. Our website is www.lightfootpodcast.com. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going, and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com. Well, the next episode of Carefree Highway Revisited will feature my guest, Jeremiah Bronson, and he and I will be talking about Harmony from the 2004 album of the same name. That episode is slated to come out in June of 2024. Until then, for Deb Radwan, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. We'll see you next time.